Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. I'm Jeff Gamet. Today is Monday. We're still in May, or we're already in May. I'm not sure which. Anyhow, it's May 21st, 2018. With me today, I have Andrew Orr. How are you, Andrew?
Hey, I'm doing good today.
Awesome. I am so glad to have you here. And John Martellaro, I hope you are well.
I am still here, actually. After the Wally fiasco, I'm surprised I'm still here.
See, this is the proof that I am a benevolent managing editor.
Yes, you are.
And host. Yeah. And yes. John, I couldn't bring myself to make an example of you. I think the public shaming on the show was plenty. Yeah,
has been sufficient. Yes.
Yeah.
Necessary and sufficient.
Yeah. And for those of you that don't know what I'm talking about.
No. We don't need to remind them.
There will be a link to that episode in the show notes.
I have editor privileges. I will go delete it.
It's so funny how you say that.
I'll have editor privileges for about the next 30 seconds.
I'm sure Andrew's going to do great taking over your job.
Definitely. Yes. Congratulations, Andrew.
Wow. Okay. Hey, so we should talk about something that you wrote about at the end of last week, John, which I thought was a really well done piece. And you were talking about iPhone, smartphone technology addiction, but iPhone specifically. And who really should be responsible for dealing with these types of problems? And you put the blame clearly in Apple's court, right?
Absolutely not. You know, in particle debris, I typically find an article I want to expound on. And this time it was my friend Michael Gartenberg at iMore who wrote, "Frankenstein's iPhone, control, don't be controlled." And he said, who's really to blame for smartphone, quote, addiction? And who's responsible for curbing it? There is this sub theme in our society that, and a lot of the readers agreed, that the iPhone is designed to be mesmerizing, addictive, touchy-feely, fidget spinner-oriented, designed to envelop you, embrace you, keep you involved. That just could be the side effect of good human interface design and great graphics. But the real issue is it Apple's responsibility to manage the way we use our phones and to take responsibility for addictive behavior or obsessive behavior. And Michael Gartenberg started off by saying basically what I agree with, that it's not Apple's fault or responsibility. There are some things you can do, and he gave a good list. Kind of wean you away from the phone. Don't go towards bigger phones that mesmerize you with a bigger screen. Turn it over to monochrome display when feasible. And, if parents can get involved in parental controls on the iPhone as well, which my take is that they don't actively do as much as I think maybe culture and society should do. So when he talked about those things that you could do in a technical way, I started thinking about behavioral patterns. And I added, after I quoted his article and linked to it and talked about it briefly, I continued the discussion based on the idea that we all need to be kind of heavily involved in a higher level of activity, doing something that where the phone is a tool, not an end in itself. So if you are teaching or writing or creating or acting, developing, doing service work, all the things that contribute to a personal goal and contribute positively to society, then the phone will be a tool to help you get that thing done. And that's the way it should be approached. And if you're busy doing the things that you ought to be doing to be productive and an adult and useful in society, then you won't spend as much time just focusing on the phone trying to fill a void. I think part of the problem is that when you don't have a sustaining high-level goal and vision for what you should be doing, you fall into the practice of looking for whatever it is you're seeking, companionship or importance, or maybe the selfie narcissism, or maybe flashing around the photos you've taken, or communicating with people to an obsessive degree. And what happens is that you find out that it's not necessarily very, very fulfilling, and in fact can be kind of depressing for teenagers. And I pointed to an NPR article that linked to a study that said that teenagers are increasingly depressed based on the number of hours they spend a day. The more hours they spend on the phone, the more depressed they are. So there's obviously something they're looking for in the phone itself, in the features and the applications, that's not giving them the psychological and emotional and cultural support that they need, that is usually derived from service work or contributions to society or your profession, your goals, the things that really make you happy in life. All right. That was my augmentation to Michael's great article.
So there's one thing that you said early on when you're talking about this, where you were talking about the things that Apple has done to make the iPhone enticing. And one of the things you said that Apple designed in an addictive quality. And I don't agree with that, but I think that there's a tendency for a lot of people to allow themselves to get addicted because of the other things that they can do with an iPhone. And
I think a good example is cars. Cars are designed to look aesthetically cool, and they have sports cars have a lot of horsepower and they handle well. And so they appeal to you because of their design. And nobody suggests that a car should be made ugly or have a weak engine. But it's still, we still assign responsibility to adults to drive, to not drive 65 in a 15-mile-an-hour school zone.
Right. And it seems like we should have the same expectation of our technology, where it's our responsibility to know how to use it correctly.
Yeah.
Another thing you talked about was, you know, like kids in school and having phones and maybe feeling depressed because of the way they're using the devices. I think in some cases, not just for kids, but for everyone, the iPhone or whatever smartphone they're using becomes a device that opens up their world. Like they may be someone that can't, for whatever reason, really interact well in public situations. And so they feel disconnected. And they instead make their meaningful relationships through their smartphones, because that's the avenue where they feel comfortable interacting with people. So in that sense, I'd say that's actually a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a lot of nuance to this. But yeah, I agree. Smartphone addiction is so much of a problem now that there are specific services like retreats where you give up technology for a month or a week and go off grid. And I think that can be very beneficial.
All right. So I'd forgotten about the retreats, and that's actually pretty cool for the people that need that. Mm-hmm. All right. So I have another question. Is it possible that people are freaking out and calling out smartphone addiction because it's the whole thing with smartphones is still relatively new for humans and for society. I remember times when I would be outside or in a restaurant or in a store somewhere, and there'd be people that they'd be with other people and they would be engrossed in a newspaper, a book, a comic book, a magazine, and they'd be walking down the street, and they have their face buried in the paper, which is not that much different from burying your face in a phone. And people haven't been complaining about that. So is it that those are socially acceptable forms of disconnecting from everyone around you, and currently smartphones are not socially acceptable?
That's a really good question. Go ahead, Andrew.
I can see that a little bit, that smartphones are just used as, I don't know what you want to call it, but just the biggest example of this. But at the same time, now we have certain studies, like John pointed out, that no, it actually is a problem. These studies are about smartphones. They're not about, you know, books or newspapers. I don't think it's necessarily the same thing, because you can do so much more with your phone. I mean, if all you did was read on your phone, then I think maybe that could be a comparable example, but it's not.
I think there's a positive aspect to it that I did not think about when I was writing the article.
Okay.
And that is, the iPhone is a sort of a second brain. I was at a car dealer where the service tech needed to capture my information real quick. And the best way to do that was, he took a snapshot of the display on a computer so he could run over to a service manager and see what the problem was. So mm-hmm. I do that all the time. I take photographs of wine bottles and restaurants, and take photographs of things I'm trying to remember for the future. And we're so integrated into the information content of the world, and we're trying to remember some piece of information. Google's our friend, and so it's an amplifier of our brain. We partner with our phone. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. because of the power it has to amplify our mental ability, when we know how to find information that we don't remember or can't use right away, but the phone helps us do that with an application, it amplifies the power of our mind, and we feel kind of empty and lost when we're not with that phone. So how do I leave this retreat? Well, you call Uber.
Right?
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Okay, so back to the original question in all of this. Whose responsibility is it to deal with iPhone and I'll just call it electronic device addiction? Is it the manufacturer's responsibility, so in this case Apple, or does it fall on the users and maybe their friends or family?
I think parents have to take a role in deciding how the phone's going to be used. There are parental controls built into the iPhone, and people keep asking for more and more. I think they're underutilized. I think part of it is my wife is a teacher, and she reports often that kids don't seem to have a vision. They're just in the class to, you know, get a grade. And when she tries to inspire them or ferret out what they're thinking about in terms of next steps in their future and their career, that's not coherently on their mind at that point.
You know, that doesn't sound any different from when I was in college and we didn't have smartphones.
Yeah, but if you have a goal and you're focused on that internship, or you're focused on that job coming out of college, you'll be using the phone as a calculator to solve your engineering problems, or you'll be using it as a research tool. It won't be an end in itself. So, I think it helps create implicit discipline in how you use the phone, by figuring out what activities are appropriate and fit in with your personal life goals, as opposed to being manipulated by advertising and just being pulled into the cyclone of the phone for the phone's sake. See what I'm saying?
Yeah. I can see where it would be easier for someone who who doesn't have the focus and the drive in school to use something like a smartphone to disconnect even more. But I'm not ready to accept that smartphones are making that more of a problem. Like I said, when I was in college and in high school, there were so many people that I saw that were there just to get by and just to finish, and it for them it wasn't smartphones, but it was other things. You know, they would have books, or they would draw, or they would get stoned and then sit in class, or you know, whatever it was, they had something else that they could turn to and and use that as their time killer while they're just waiting for the school day to end. And I think smartphones and tablets and computers, they fit into that just the same. And it's just a matter of, this is the newest way for people to create excuses to disconnect in school. And at some point we'll have other things. So, you know, like maybe we'll have smart glasses. And you can sit there and put a holographic image on the front of the lenses, so it looks like your eyes are blinking and tracking the instructor, while on the inside of the lenses you're watching movies. Oh, dudes, I have to do a Kickstarter right now. That's going to be a brilliant product.
That's perfect.
Yeah. So it'll always be something. And my feeling is, it is not the company's responsibility to stop people from feeling compelled to use the product. It's, I mean, in this case, what it tells me is that Apple and other device makers, they've done a really good job making products that are compelling. And then we have developers out there who are making services and apps that are very compelling. And so people want to use them. And just like everything else, it's up to us to use all of those things at our disposal appropriately. And if we don't have the ability to do that, then we either need to find ways to get that managed for us, or the people in our lives need to help us make that happen.
Every once in a while you hear about a movie director who shoots some footage and edits it in iMovie on his phone and has learned to exercise the power of what Apple's delivered to us for productive purposes. And in order to achieve that kind of power, Apple has to do all the things that it does. So how we use it is up to us.
Hey, we have 2 minutes left, and I want to talk about something else, apparently really quick. How about that teen save? man. Okay, so the quick version for those of you that aren't up on this story, TeenSafe is a service that parents can use to monitor their children's online activity and location on their smartphones and iPhones, of course, as part of that. And they recently suffered a data breach that is totally their own fault. They were storing Apple IDs, usernames and passwords, on AWS servers. So these are Amazon's cloud servers. And they didn't have their servers locked down, meaning TeenSafe didn't have their servers locked down. So people could get at this database of all these usernames and passwords. Okay, now we're going to put some salt in the wound. Everything was stored in plain text. So usernames and passwords, all in plain text. More salt in the wound. To use their service, you have to have two-factor authentication disabled. So over 10,000 kids' usernames and passwords for Apple IDs out in the wild. How's that for awesome?
Andrew, yeah, you found it. You start.
I think that there really needs to be more like punishment for these companies, because if you're storing private information like passwords and other things, and you're not taking reasonable steps to protect it, if you're leaving the server public with plain text passwords, then you probably shouldn't be in business anymore. I think this is just completely ridiculous.
Yeah, I see it as a very irresponsible move on the company's part, and of course, I'm sure they had no intention of having publicly accessible servers. But even with that, there's no valid reason whatsoever to be storing usernames and passwords for Apple IDs in a plain text file.
You know, we have societal historical ways of dealing with this. We certify engineers to design bridges so that they're safe. We license restaurants if the health department says they're not safe. They pull their license to operate. Maybe it's time we have licenses to operate for companies where they have to submit information about what kind of information they're collecting and how they're going to protect it before. And if they don't do that, their license to operate is pulled.
Well, that's basically what the EU is doing with GDPR.
Yeah, I'm completely on board with that.
Yeah. Now, of course, GDPR, it doesn't give you a license to operate your business. But what it does is put in penalties that are so severe that you won't be able to run your business because you'll be out of business. So the EU's doing something, regardless of whether or not you think it's the right solution, that something is happening. When I read this news, I had to go back and read it twice because I was certain I was missing a key element that would tell me I had misinterpreted everything I read, or that there was some reason why this, a valid reason why this would have happened. And nope, this just seems like a horribly irresponsible move on TeenSafe's part. And they can apologize all they want, but the fact that they were even storing Apple ID login information in plain text anywhere is unconscionable.
Yeah.
I was equally scathing of the company in the article I wrote today. So I'll make sure that I include a link to that in the show notes. And we're out of time, so we have to wrap up. Listeners, if you have anything that you want to say about iPhone addiction or what happened with TeenSafe, I would love to hear it. Whether you're supporting my take on both topics or if you're taking up a contrary position, I am totally cool with that, and I would love to hear from you. So shoot me emails. That would be observations@macobserver.com. Send me tweets. That would be @TMO Daily. And of course, you can leave comments in the show notes. I'm going to look all those places to see what you have to say, and I'm looking forward to your comments. John, thanks for being here today.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
And Andrew, thank you for being here as well.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have both of you. Also, before we go, I want to let everyone know I'm going to be at Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference this year, and I'm going to be interviewing developers all week long. So if you are a developer or you know a developer that's going to be at WWDC and you want me to highlight them in a video interview, please get them in contact with me. All the same ways that you can leave me messages about the show will work. And I'll be doing interviews all week long. And they don't even have to be going to WWDC. If they're going to be at AltConf, that's great. And I believe LayersConf is there as well. And and I think there's one more, but I'm just forgetting off the top of my head. Sorry about that. Whichever conference you are that I'm forgetting. Anyhow, I will have a space set up at AltConf where I can conduct interviews throughout the day, and I would love to talk to you or the people that you know. So let those people know so I can get them scheduled in for interviews. And listeners, thanks again for being here. It's always great to have you. See you again tomorrow.